Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good day. Welcome to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Dr. Charles Cotillo of the Royal Historical Society. I'm a host on the channel, and today we are pleased to have with us historian author Professor Anthony Pagden. Professor Pagden is professor of political science at UCLA. He has been a fellow of Merton College, Oxford, and has written several acclaimed books, among which are Lords of All the Worlds, The World at War, and The Enlightenment, Why It Still Matters. And today we're discussing his newest book, The Pursuit of Europe, A History, published by Oxford University Press. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you.
Professor, why did you write this book?
Oh, it's a long story. I suppose the real reason has to do with a gradual and increasing concern over the future of the European project, which, of course, was made more sharp by Brexit. But I started writing this long before Brexit, in fact, 2 or 3 years before Brexit. And it's also a continuation of a long-term project, which goes back to at least one of the books you mentioned, which was Lords of All the World, which is one of the early accounts I did, which is a comparative history of the Spanish, British, and French empires in the 16th and 19th centuries. And it struck me that what was happening here was part of a longer process of the unification of unification is too strong a word, but certainly the bringing together of a political project or series of political projects in which all major European nations of Europe at one time or another were involved. And that the empire was a key to that. In the last chapter of that book, what I considered was various projects which took place during the course of the latter early part of the 19th century, both in the United States and in Spanish America and in Spain itself, for a transformation of empire into federation. And that also, of course, is something the British took up again in the 19th century. And in a way, you can see the development of the EU, the current European Union, as being not, I would stress, an attempt to, as some have claimed, to preserve the European imperial powers come what may by turning them into a kind of collective body, but certainly to transform that sort of desire for empire, so to speak, into something more benign, something more collective, and something more concerned with the continent of Europe itself. So it has an intellectual side to it. It also has a personal side to it, because I spent a lot of my time in Europe. I'm married to a European and to an Italian. Of course, I was myself European until last year. And so it's also a personal concern with what is happening to this continent, to which I have so much personally invested, despite the fact that I'm also an American citizen and I live in the United States as well.
Has the concept of Europe passed the test presently, which is the war in Ukraine?
That is a very good question. And I don't know whether – I think the jury is still out. I think so far it has done much better than it did during the Balkan crisis of the 90s. And we'll have to see what happens. I mean, it's obviously a very the union finds itself in a very difficult position. One of the weaknesses of the union, of course, as you know, is that the original plan, which goes back the way to 1951, was to have a military wing to it. And it doesn't have that. That was voted down by the French in the first instance, and then would have been voted down, I imagine, if it had come to the board by almost any other nation in Europe. It's very difficult to put together a collective armed forces of nation states. And so what it looks at, and certainly this is what happened some months back, Emmanuel Macron was calling for a revision of this idea of a European defense force. So a greater sense of European independence of NATO, but also a greater role for Europe within NATO. So there's not really a question, answer to your question, but I think that has Europe played the part it should have played? I think it's done extremely well so far, and it remains to be seen what it will do in the future. It could have done a lot more. Whether by doing a lot more, the results would have been for the Ukrainians better or worse, of course, is another matter.
Why do you say that Charlemagne's legacy is deeply problematic?
Well, I think that the problematization goes back to what I said about this idea of a unifying force within the Union, so that we have the idea of Charlemagne as an Holy Roman Emperor, an Emperor and a Holy Roman Emperor, bringing together the entire continent under the umbrella of one sovereign ruler. And this has always been the problem. I mean, you go all the way back to the 19th century when the first sort of really serious projects for and at various levels and by various people to construct a unified Europe, which then used the phrase United States of Europe, which was also used, I should say, in 1951 and in the original charter for the coal and steel community. This idea of the United States being the United States of America was being some kind of model. And the idea then was, we have a super state in a sense, and the super state will, of course, be run, generally speaking, by whoever it is writing the project. In the case of Victor Hugo, for instance, in the mid-19th century, it was, of course, France, that you would have a super state, and the super state would have its capital in Paris, et cetera, et cetera. And that is precisely what the European Union has tried to avoid, and precisely what these projects of unification have tried to avoid. So the idea of Charlemagne as a model is problematical. He is a great figure in European history because, of course, he brings together these scattered monarchies across what is now mostly Central Europe, of course, not the whole world, and France, and establishes a sort of union between them after the fall of the Roman Empire in the West. So it creates a kind of unification, a kind of principle of unification, which is why you adopted Charlemagne as a patron, that we have a Charlemagne Prize and so on and so forth. But I think if you look deeply at what Charlemagne was trying to do and what, in a sense, the Holy Roman Empire ended up as being, was much more of a sort of unified state, albeit in the case of the it didn't actually succeed in achieving that, but that was always the objective. And I think as far as the EU is concerned, that's never really been, rather more than the reverse of that, has been to avoid that objective. We don't want a super state. That is what is not intended to be.
Why do you say that Kant, quote, left his mark on almost all thinking about the possibility of a future world order, unquote?
Well, because Kant's perpetual peace first of all, it was extremely widely read at a crucial stage. It was taken up by the French Revolution as it translated into French, actually offered Kant, who was then pretty old and actually suffering from Alzheimer's as far as we now know, a position as to write a constitution for the new French Republic. So there was already a sort of political background to it. And I think the reason why is it's been taken up and it's constantly referred to, as the last instance, probably Gorbachev's reference during the acceptance of his Nobel Peace Prize speech, is that Kant had seen what few others had seen. He isn't the first person, no one ever is the first person or anything, but had seen that in order to bring together a collection of states, and don't forget Kant was talking about the whole world and not about Europe, so this is a different sort of project in a sense, but he had seen that in order to bring together a collection of states, those states had to have a certain juridical order in common. They had to have a political order of some sort in common, and that previously all attempts to unite Europe or projects to unite Europe, most of them have been fantastical, and they go right the way back to the the latter part of the 16th century, and they'd all, of course, been attempts to bring warfare to an end, that these had all been based upon the assumption that you would get together very different sorts of communities, very different sorts of nations, of very different legal systems and so on. I mean, there's a common legal system throughout Europe, but it's a very fine level, so to speak. But you bring republics and you bring monarchies and you bring dictatorships and you bring baronies and you bring all of these together, and somehow they'd all get on together, although they didn't share any common understanding, a common set of views about what a civilization, or what a civitas, what a city is, what a nation is, what a state is, etc. Kant understood that that wasn't going to work, and that the only way to make it work, to make this, bring this body together, would be to ensure that all of them subscribe to what he, to one single political, juridical political system. And that was what he called representative republic. And it was one which, of course, looks very like, although in many respects his conception is not like that, but it looks very like a modern form of democracy. So it suited, of course, later generations, post-revolution, post-French revolution generations very well, as to say, as part of, as it were, what has come to be called the democratic peace theory, that if you have, you know, a group of states, and all of them are in some sense representative to democracies, or at least they all adhere to a single set of a single body of law, which is representative, a political system is representative, then they will not go to war with one another, and they will be able to come to accord to one another, and they will be able to create what Kant saw as being a universal, he never talks about it quite as a federation, because he uses very many terms in different places. He does talk about a Volkerbund, which is a bond of peoples, and a cosmopolis, and an alliance, and so on. But these various terms, because there's nothing very precise about how those fit together, don't matter. What matters is that all of these will share this common body of don't hesitate to use the word values, because it's really a commitment to a system of law. It's a commitment to a system of rule. It goes beyond the simple sharing of sort of individual values. But this will allow states to come together in such a way that they will form a union between themselves, and gradually that union, in his view, he doesn't actually explicitly ever say that's going to start in Europe, but one assumes that that's what he had in mind. Well, of course, he refers to France as in one place as being the kind of model that union will then create a broader union in which eventually all states will come to subscribe to. And I think that inspiration, that vision, reduced to its simple core, because what Kant has to say is a lot more complicated than that, and a lot more metaphysical than that. But what it comes down to is that core is very easily reproducible by people who were looking at, say, the foundation of the League of Nations in 1919, and again the United Nations after 1945, as being a kind of model. Not that the United Nations follows Kant's proposed in any way whatsoever, but nevertheless that basic idea that there is going to be a common core of legal obligations. In the United Nations case, it's really those called the core of legal obligations that are set out in the Charter of Human Rights in 1948 that's going to hold these peoples together. Of course, with the United Nations, you have very different sorts of government trying to get along together, and it doesn't work very well, as Kant assumed it wouldn't. But that is basically the reason why. That's the inspiration. And it goes on, in a sense, being the inspiration. Because the other thing is, you could say there were a number of peace treaties. A number of peace projects, which Kant was very well aware of. As I said, it goes all the way back to the 16th century. And the most important, of course, was the one drawn up by, supposedly written by Henry IV of France in 1600. And these were all inspirations in some sense for what Kant was doing. But what you get with Kant is something quite different. You get a real proposal written as a peace treaty, which looks as though it might work. It's going to work on the very long time, as he says. This is a project for future time. He even says at one point, it's never going to happen at all, but if we can imagine it, then we can get something like it. Whereas all the other ones were just chimeras, one person said, you know. And Kant himself likened these to a house on so perfectly constructed that when a bird sat in it, it fell to pieces. So, you know, that you have to have something that's much more robust than any that went preceded it. And that was, so in the context of that literature, if you're looking for inspiration within it, you're a politician, a statesman, you're looking for inspiration with that, and indeed, then that is the text you're likely to go to.
Why was Bonaparte an important figure in your book?
Well, I think for a number of reasons. One, because three basic reasons. One, because he's been represented as standing for a kind of a form of French imperialism, which goes under the name of Bonapartism, which is said by many to still exist today, although in a much more muted form. Two, which I don't believe for a minute, but that's certainly those people who are hostile to the European Union like to see it as a sort of Bonapartist project. You know, having failed to conquer Europe by arms, the French have now conquered Europe by forms of diplomacy and treaty building. The other aspect of it is that he is one of the first to begin to make claims about unifying Europe. Now, you don't have to believe those claims. I mean, the man was an opportunist of the first order. So, and a lot of the stuff that he says, as I say in the first chapter of the book, about unifying Europe is in fact said when he's sitting in exile on this island in the Atlantic, and so hasn't got much else to do. And he's sitting there trying with this man Lascaux, who's his amanuensis, trying to create an image for him, very self-consciously, trying to create an image for himself for past generations. I mean, one of the interesting things about Napoleon wrote a great deal, and he's a highly literate man. And he's, from the very beginning, he's interested in two basic things. One is expanding the glory of France and himself at the same time, and secondly, to make sure that past generations understood what he intended to do, or rather, that past generations understood what he wanted them to understand, what he intended to do. And so, and one of the things that he claims, and he's one of those, is precisely that he's trying to unify what he called the great European family. But the vision was that this Europe had been united under the Greeks, it had been united under the Romans, it had been split apart by a whole series of warring and fording little kingdoms, and those little kingdoms had stayed in power in one sort or another as tyrannical rulers until the 18th century, when the French Revolution had changed the political landscape completely, introduced a new form of government, that is to say democratic republicanism, of which he was now the representative. And that was going to restore this sense of equilibrium and balance, which had been wiped out by the fall of by the Gothic invasion, in particular the sack of Rome. So that image, that fantastical historical image, was very crucial to him. And I think it's something that, and it has been revised. Subsequently, it's as I say in the book, it plays a quite considerable role in contemporary French politics, because that's the sort of right-wing view of Napoleon. The left-wing view of Napoleon is more the one who's kind of disrupted any form of possible concord within France itself. So the figure plays large. You can't think about European unification without them. The other most important thing, I think, is that the real attempt to do something more than just talk, and not that I'm against talking, because that's what I'm interested in, but and writing, but actually to create a project, starts with the fall of Napoleon. So Napoleon, malgré lui, brings into play something which does. That's the third of the reasons. And this third reason is that the fall of Napoleon brings into play two things. It brings into play, one, the recognition by those powers that managed to defeat him, that whatever happens afterwards, despite their attempts to turn back the clock, to go back to all the way back to before 1789 and create another Europe of consolidated monarchies, war with one another. They recognize that isn't going to happen, and that the monarchies that follow in the 19th century are going to have to be different. The ones that survive are going to have to be different, first of all. Then they're going to have to cooperate with each other to a much greater extent than they did in the past. So the consequence of the getting together, the bringing together of these forces, which of course interestingly include Russia for the very first time, which have been instrumental in bringing down Napoleon, instrumental in creating a new European order, will now, as it were, collaborate with one another. And so you have what starts what is thereafter called the Century of Vienna, because of the Congress of Vienna and the great power, the concert of the great powers in there, which is seen by many, not by all by any means, but seen by many as a kind of European unification. You know, there are various foresighted, most of them diplomats of one sort or another, thinkers who think, okay, well, this is the beginning of something. This is really the beginning of a unification. The great powers are still independent great powers. There's still the idea that you could bring France, Germany, because Germany doesn't exist yet, but you can bring France and Germany and Russia in particular together into some sort of union is outrageous, completely impossible. But it's the beginning of the possibility that you might think about at least a treaty arrangement between these groups, which will somehow bring an end to warfare, which of course within Europe, which is what's crucial, bring greater prosperity to Europe, and eventually create a system of alliances between Europeans, which will bring into being, if not a European Union, if not a single republic, but certainly as some kind of coalition of powers. And the Century of Vienna is called that because, of course, the view, and it's not entirely true, as I say in the book, I mean, the view is there's no war between 1815 and 1914. So it's 100 years of perpetual peace created out of the ruins of the Napoleonic imperial project, created by this unification. Now, there are, in fact, lots of wars, of which Crimea, of course, is the most important, and not to mention, of course, the German invasion of France and the creation of the German Second Reich. But the wars were nothing like the same scale as the Napoleonic Wars. They were nothing like the same scale as the First Years' War in the 17th century. And so it was, in one sense, it's legitimate to think about this as being a period of peace and relative prosperity. Of course, that all falls apart in the 19th, with the Great War. And what comes after that is completely different. And what comes after that, there's no trace of Napoleon at all. The other thing that Napoleon left behind, which is crucial and survives to this day, is the motivation, because it wasn't his construction at all, the motivation for nationalism. I mean, nationalism is what, in a sense, had led to Napoleon's destruction. And most thinkers at the time recognized this, that if it hadn't been for Napoleon, these nation states that came into being in the course of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century, which fought for independence, those states, I mean, it was Napoleon's attempt to, as it were, subject them, Poland, for instance, or Italy, rather than simply free them as independent nations, that led to the creation of modern nationalism. The creation of modern nationalism obviously has many other reasons, many other motives behind it. But one of the things that made nationalism, as to say the ideology of nationalism, possible, was paradoxically the resistance to Napoleon. So that is why I think that's the point where one starts. I don't want to suggest, as some some people on the French right have suggested, that actually, fact, you know, the EU, modern Europe, is somehow a sort of legacy of Napoleon, creation of Napoleon. I don't think it's all. I think the very reverse is true. But Napoleon did, as it were, both set a possible agenda, which of course was never followed through, but also by creating these conditions, by being defeated, his very defeat by creating these conditions made it possible to think 100 years later, which is really when it all starts, with the Great War, which is the last great, second great conflict between the European powers, although of course it's also a conflict worldwide as well, of a possibility that really there might be something in the future that could be called a European Union.
What is the difference in the book between primordial nationalism and civic nationalism?
The difference I try to make here is that nationalism goes, and this is, I should say first of all that this is the debate about this is ongoing and it's never likely to come to an end, and it's very difficult to pin down anything very precise or come up with any very clear theories. But in short, nationalism began in the 19th century as a nationalism, not the nation. The nation's a much older construction. A lot of, I should say, this is a parenthesis, but a lot of the theorists of nationalism take start, as it were, in the 14th, 15th, 12th century, or whatever, as though nation and nationalism are one and the same thing. They're not. And I think that when we talk about the ideologies of nationalism, we understand today by that. We recognize the day by that. We don't really go much back before this period of 1815, this period of the collapse of the Napoleonic Empire. That is not to say for a minute that the great powers of Europe, the great nations of Europe, the great nations of the world, for that matter, don't have a very strong sense of themselves as nations long before that they do. But nationalism isn't quite that. Nationalism is a drive that says essentially that there is one space, one people, one religion, one language, one law, and that belongs to this particular plot of land. It's commensurate with this particular plot of land. If you look at the nationalisms of the past, they combine certain bits and pieces of that. But, for instance, the question of territories and borders doesn't really enter into it. Really, that's what begins in the early part of the 19th century. So, and that nationalism, it's as it's pushed forward, and the two figures I've drawn on in the book are, in a sense, the major ones are Giuseppe Mazzini, who is the Italian architect of Italian independence, and though not a great theorist in his own right, because he never wrote a substantial major book, he wrote endless pamphlets, was looked upon by contemporary Europeans as one of the great thinkers of the age, particularly on this matter. Johann Gottfried Herder, who was a German writing really in the aftermath of Count, long before Napoleon, of course, in his case, but they set up this idea of, and Herder's nationalism is far more primordial, as you would put it. I mean, much more concerned with the idea of a folk, of a people, of a space, and so on. But the important thing about both of these forms of thinking about the nation and that what nationalism is that they're not naturally antagonistic to other nations. They fit quite nicely into Kant's own project, because Kant's project was to bring together all the nations of the world, but bring them together as nations. He was a great anti at that stage in his life, not later. Kant was a great anti-imperialist, and anything that looked like an amalgamation of nations to him looked like an empire, and that, as he said, was the graveyard of freedom. So to have a confederation, you had to make sure that each or other, to have a grouping of states together, a cosmopolitan order of states, those states all had to be independent states, qua states. They all had to have an independence together. What they had to do was to share a basic set of common beliefs and common interests. So that was the notion. Now, what happens to this, of course, is that, and that the story is, and they're very aware of taking this, that this gets taken up, particularly in 19th century Germany, and particularly by starting with Hegel, who have transforms, and he is the greatest theorist of the state that's ever lived. I mean, he thinks of the state as something quite different, as a transformation of the human spirit, as something that exists as a way of making humans human. And that, so it transcends these other forms of life. And he puts together this idea of the nation with the state, which is the construction of power, the body of power that goes with the nation and creates what we think of as the nation state. Now, that nation state conceived by him and then in vulgarized forms by a lot of his successors, and they are more influential than he is himself, because if you read him carefully, you see he's not saying a lot of things that they claim he's saying. They believe that this is that there is these sort of primordial units, human units, which are called nation states. These nation states can only exist in conflict with one another. That's part of their needs. The question of the other, which has become so dominant in rather sort of vulgar political thinking that you need an other in order to be someone. So you have to have an opponent, you have to have an enemy. This is taken up, of course, by Carl Schmitt during the Third Reich in Nazi Germany. So you then have this idea that we are the single primordial nation. All other nations in some sense are our enemies and our opponents. And that's the much comes much closer to being what modern nationalism. There are a lot of a lot of opponents to this view, I should say. I mean, I'm giving you a very, very simple view of it. But the kind of nationalism that has driven the populist parties of the right and of the left, I should say, in Europe today, the kind of nationalism which has driven Brexit, the kind of nationalism which is opposed to this larger unification of peoples, be it on a European level or a global level, that nationalism, I think, derives from this late 19th century German version, is much bolderized and, of course, greatly strengthened by National Socialism and Fascism in the 1920s and 30s. And of course, as a consequence of that, it's now become unacceptable. So unacceptable for all but extremists on the far right and the far left. So that is the distinction. I think you could say we could have a nationalism which says, yes, we have to respect people's national boundaries. We have to respect their national interests. You know, we have to think about how small a unit is the state going to be. We have to think people have things in common and so on. We can do all of that while at the same time belonging to some greater order to which we are beholden. And I should say, and this is your next question, that this is also very closely linked to the question of sovereignty. And that's the crucial issue. That becomes the crucial political issue with modern nationalism.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
For the reasons you just described, is that why you refer to Mazzini as the, quote, the single founding father of the EU, unquote?
I think I say that I haven't got the text with me that he could be so considered, yes. He has a text which talks about the United States of Europe, and there's one way you could say that. But again, this is not his phrase. That goes back to the 18th century. I think that the kind of vision that Mazzini has, and the vision that Mazzini is recognized as having by those who read him at the time, because as I say, he was a very widely read, very, very influential person, would be considered to be the closest thing that one can think about it. Founding father, not of course in the American sense of, or indeed the European sense of the term, but the inspiration behind what was going to be. It's also, of course, you know, it wasn't just, as I say, it's not just for Europe. It's a broader sense. There's a broader sense of his vision, which goes beyond Europe. But he's primarily concerned, of course, since he's primarily concerned with Italy above all, with Europe. But there are many passages where he talks about, you know, the world. We think about the whole of the global union. Eventually, the globe will be organized along some sort of similar lines. But yes, that's if you're looking for a single inspirational figure or what should be the inspiration behind it, then that's the one you might choose.
How did the concept of the extra-European empires impact on the European idea before 1914?
Ah, well, that is a major question, because that is, as I was trying to say earlier, in a sense, one of the things that transformed the whole way of thinking about Europe, because it, first of all, the first thing is to bear in mind that, as I say in I think it's chapter four, that the what happens after 1815 is that the Europeans cease to fight each other and they start fighting other people overseas. So they the energy, so to speak, that went into internecine warfare within Europe now goes into creating external empires. Now, that it's not that those empires didn't exist before, clearly. So it would be absurd if they start in the 15th century. But the kind of empires that are created in the 19th century, which are nationalist empires, right? They're born of particular nation states, and they're competitive with one another in the way that not to say the Portuguese and the Spanish and the French weren't competitive, they were, but they're not competitive to anything like the degree they become competitive in the 19th century. So you have this sense in which the state is being created, the new modern nation state is slowly being created as a consequence of its imperial overseas reach. But having an empire in the 19th century becomes a symbol of great powerdom. If you don't have an empire, you're nobody. There's a phrase by Edward Curzon, Lord Curzon, Viceroy of India, who says at one point, you know, if we give up India, we drop immediately to the third rate. This, and Tocqueville, writing about Algeria, and on the whole, Tocqueville was very hostile to sort of overseas empire, but talking about the need to hang on to Algeria and indeed to transform Algeria into what he calls a part of France on the far side of the Mediterranean, says precisely that. You know, France has now come back into the elite, so to speak, the family of nations. After the Napoleonic Wars, it's been reestablished as a central part of Europe, great power. It will not succeed in maintaining that position unless it has an overseas possession. And this Algeria is the most important one we have. And, it, you know, you can see this perception goes right the way down to the 1960s. And it's still being aired in the war fought for liberation of Algeria in the 1960s. So I think that has a great impact on it. Of course, what the other side of it, the other side of the story, is that the Great War is a war between empires. So it's not just wars within Europe. It takes place outside Europe as well. And, of course, it brings in former European colonies, such as most importantly the United States, into play. So one of the things that happens after this Great War is, of course, a gradual scaling back. I mean, it's not the creation of United Nations mandates and so on. The destruction of the three of the greatest empires that existed at the time, and the rolling back of the imperial project, so that when 1940, so that during the course of that period, but in the interwar years, there is a lot of talk. And most of it's just talk, it's true. But, I mean, a lot of it goes on in very high places. First of all, of course, the League of Nations, which is going to be a league that's going to be a league of leagues. Right? So it's not just going to be – the idea was that there would be a league of all the nations of the world, but it was made up of a league of nations. One of those leagues, of course, would be the European League. So it was already beginning to – they were already beginning to think on a sort of global political scale about bringing these various nations together. Then, of course, you have – all of that, you know, gets, and then you have lots of people thinking about possibilities of world government. This is a great period of reflection, and of course the rise of federalism. Federalism as a project becomes very important in this period. And interestingly, not just within Europe, but also outside Europe. And a lot of the places which become subsequently decolonized, most crucially India, begin to toy with the idea, which is then overruled in the end, of creating a new independent India as a federation and not as a nation state. The nation state is what has created the problems in the 19th century. It has created the empire, it has created the Great War, and therefore we need to find an alternative form of political arrangement. And the most obvious one is a federation. So, and this, in a sense, is what's replayed out again in 1945. So you have the empires begin to dissolve. And after, of course, the Second World War, all of those empires, with the exception of the British, disappear completely. So almost completely. The French still hang on to bits and pieces here until the 1960s. Algeria, most crucially, as we know. But as far as it being being imperial powers and conceiving themselves as imperial powers, that's gone. And at that stage, it becomes much, much easier, of course, and for these various nations to come to some agreement among themselves about some kind of union. between themselves, because so long as they're competing imperial nations, which they are throughout the 19th century, they share a lot in common. They speak a common language. They try to establish a universal world order in which they're all going to participate. The creation of international law is part of that story, which I also tried to tell in the book. But they still remain very separate and possibly antagonistic states in certain other way. They're not fighting themselves any longer, but there's always the possibility that some kind of war might break out between them, as breaks out, of course, in the Crimea, in overseas. So when that ceases to be possible, there is no longer that sort of competition any longer. And so it becomes possible to think of developing this kind of sense of Europeanness, which has been developing in the 19th century, although it hasn't had a political form of any shape, giving that some sort of political form now that the empires themselves are de facto no more. And this, of course, is one of the things that makes Britain so difficult, because Britain is the only one. It's the only one of the European powers, excuse Russia, of course, the only one of the European powers to have been a victor. It couldn't have done it on its own, of course, although it tries to present that it could have done, but it couldn't have done it on its own. But it was a victor, and none of the other European powers were. So that made a huge difference in self-representation. And, of course, it still had a very considerable empire and was still trying to hold on to it until the late 40s, early 50s. In fact, there were some who wanted to try and get it back even in the late 60s. And so I think the idea, and it was always said, all of those debates that went on in the 40s about what Europe's role would be with regard to the new Europe, always circled around this idea, what are we going to do about the empire? And still it is today. And Brexit was partly about that. You know, I mean, what are we going to do about Brexit? Right, we're going to form a state which is going to be dependent on our former colonies, basically, starting with the United States. We're going to be dependent. They're not dependent on us, and we're dependent on them, but it's going to be United States, Australia, and New Zealand. And so that constant harping back, both politically and economically, to an imperial order made it very difficult after 48, 45, 46, when the projects for the European Union began to consolidate, for the British actually to take any part. They could quite happily take part in a customs union. And make quite substantial concessions to the customs union. But anything that looked as it might be more far-reaching than that, and, you know, as I keep picking the book, people tend to think the beginnings, that's all the European Union was. It wasn't. If you look at the treaties of 1951, the founding treaty, in a sense, which founds the iron, steel, and coal community, that is still very much committed to a larger picture. And the larger picture is indeed, if not a federal state, at least some kind of holistic European Union in the future, which Britain has never really been able to pay lip service to. It paid lip service and after the referendum and, you know, there was these great ceremonies in London and so on. I remember them clearly. The triumph of Europe. Everyone thought this was the beginning of a new world and so on and so forth. But it was quite clearly it wasn't. And it only required something small to start going wrong when the whole thing collapsed. So I think that goes back to that's one of the roles that the empires plays in this whole sad story.
How does the Briand plan fit into your narrative, and why did it fail?
Well, I don't know. I mean, various reasons it failed. It wasn't systematic enough, and it didn't go far enough. I think that's the problem. Also, in a way, you could say it was there before its time. At that time, what people were thinking of, first of all, most of the great were thinking in global terms and not in terms of European terms. So the truth is, and the Briand plan is part of it's in a sense a mishmash of the two. And so Europe is still, as I said, going to be part of a union within unions, of a league within leagues. It's not going to be something separate and by itself, which is fine. I mean, which is wholly admirable in the sense, really, indeed, what it is. It has to be thought of in those terms. But the project after 1919 was to bring world peace to the world and not just to Europe. And I think that was the that was one of the difficulties with that project. That it the whole thing was never clearly enough thought through. The other aspect of it, of course, is that given the situation after the end of the First World War, it was very unlikely that that sort of cohesion could be brought together, particularly since the United States, which had been so much of, an instrumental part in creating the League in the first place, would have no part of it. So if you were going to have a world order with one major power, and one major power which was not only major in terms of its military might, its economic powers and so on, but also was deemed to be in some sense intellectually and ideologically at the center of what this union was supposed to be, wasn't part of it, then it really had no chance of going anywhere.
Carl Schmitt occupies a prominent place in your story. Why so? And would it be true to say that, oddly enough, he seems to have become more influential post-1945 rather than pre-1945?
So I didn't catch the beginning of that. What becomes more influential?
Carl Schmitt seems to have become more influential, intellectually speaking, post-1945 rather than pre-1945.
Well, yes, I think so. But I mean, Carl Schmitt is a strange character because he was, as you know, the crown jurist of the Third Reich. I mean, he had this perception of sovereignty and so on, which fitted very nicely with what Hitler wanted to understand, although he didn't get on very well with Hitler at all. But the thing about Carl Schmitt that has been taken up by a lot of people on the left and on the right and on the left, because it fits in, his conception fits in the sense of the absolute control the state has over its resources, so that the sovereign, as Carl Schmitt famously says, is he who makes the exception. The rule, the laws of rule exist for everyone except when there's an exception, and the sovereign is the person who decides there's an exception. So there has to be a sovereign body which regulates life on a day-to-day basis, but that state has always to be prepared to go against the grain, to break the laws, to break the rules if necessary. And there has to be an absolute sort of Hobbesian central power to it. So that appealed to both left and right, and it's been something it's an anti-liberal view. And a lot of the things, in a lot of influence that's going around in universities, particularly in the United States and so on, is sort of anti-liberalism, and Carl Schmitt is the anti-liberalism, anti-liberal par excellence. But he happens to be talking from the position, or was talking rather, when he wrote these things, from the position of the extreme right. Doesn't seem to worry the extreme left at all. But, of course, the views come out looking very much, someone like George O'Gambin, for instance, who's very popular, takes most of what he says, as far as I can tell, is largely derived from Schmitt, takes this extreme view. So that the sort of intellectual, sort of academic level, if you like, Mr. The other aspect is, I think, that which I wanted to stress in the book rather more, was that he was, after all, first and foremost a jurist, and he was very much, he wrote, his most influential books were written on the conception of international law, and that it's that aspect of how he sees the interrelationship between states, which is very different from this kind of maniacal figure that he represents with regard to the control within individual states. Of course, the individual states have to have absolute sovereign authority, he never questions that point, but there is the what he sees as the Grosse Raum, the great areas, the possibility of having something that lies between a federation on the one hand and a state on the other. And this was something that was being proposed, independently. It's taken out. It's not actually his idea. I wouldn't put it this way. Its first formulation isn't his first formulation. It already exists in Germany in the 1920s. But he takes this idea up that you can have a kind of group of states that share a common interest, in which, as he said, there is a dominant political principle. He doesn't say it has to be a particularly, and of course, when the Nazis take this up, that the dominant political principle becomes national socialism. But it doesn't have to be national socialism. I mean, democracy, it can be fascism, it can be communism, it can be anything. The point is, what holds it together is that. And his model, somewhat ironically, was the Monroe Doctrine. But he believed that the Monroe Doctrine was what the Americans were trying to get at. The Americans were trying to say, look, we have an area of control, of influence, which reads all the way from Canada to Chile, because this is the Western Hemisphere. We are the most powerful state in the Western Hemisphere. We don't govern these states. We don't tell them what to do. But we have a considerable area of interest over their actions and behaviors. We form leagues with them. We assist them in times of difficulty. And crucially, we make sure, in the case of the American case, and this, of course, is Alexander Hamilton's view as well, we keep the Europeans out. We don't want any attempt at reconquering the Americas. The Americas are independent. And he thought this was, Schmidt thought this was a model that could become something in Eastern Europe, right? Not West. He wasn't thinking of East, Western Europe, nor of course, of Hitler. This is something that could be applied to Eastern Europe. So the Nazis, the Germans would have, they wouldn't have total sovereign imperial control over them. That wouldn't happen. That's, of course, what eventually was attempted. But that, in the first instance, was not his vision. His vision was much more indirect, that they would be a sort of, you know, guiding power. But it would be crucial, and this goes back again to Kant's view, it would be crucial that all of these states shared what Schmitt called the same common political principle. And of course, in the American case, the idea was that's going to be democracy. And in the German case, it would have been national socialism. In the Russian case, which is not unlike what, I mean, Putin doesn't talk in these terms because he doesn't know these figures and he's not alluding to this history. But a lot of what he's saying sounds quite similar to that. And again, there, it's some kind of odd form of neo-Christianism that's coming out of the revival of the Orthodox Church and the reconstruction of the old Tsarist Empire. But that sort of image, I think, is what makes, how vague that might sound, Schmitt quite interesting.
Why did your self-evidently correct and true statement that Islam is not a European religion come in for criticism?
I don't think that it was said in the context of that being I don't think it's not a formative. I mean, there are Muslims in Europe, but let me get one thing straight about that. Europe has a strong Christian antecedence to it, but the European Union is not a Christian entity, right? It is a wholly secular body of states brought together. It shares, because the European culture is steeped in Christianity, a number of things in common with Christianity. It also diverges very markedly from Christianity, both in the past and today, the most obvious being the question of the status of women, which is crucial to the EU, crucial to the way that European Union sees itself, and is still, of course, betrayed by most of the churches, not all of them, but certainly by the Catholic Church. So there's nothing Christian about it. I've tried to make a point in that thing that one shouldn't overlook the Christian formation of it, the ways in which this went into the building of it. But it has been in the process entirely and utterly secularized, so that because a lot of the Christian bits that it chose to emphasize were already secularized in the 18th century. So that Islam, the claim that was being made there was that Islam was in some way a formative religion. This is the objection to that particular comment that was made in the creation of it, in the sense that it had existed for many years in the south of Europe. And I think that is quite wrong. I mean, there are certain ways in which you can accommodate yourself to Islam, okay? But it's not easy, and it's not easy because Islam does not, if you're a true Muslim, you do not accept the distinction between the secular powers, church and state, so to speak, the secular powers and religion, the religious powers, and you do not accept certain basic things that we would consider to be, and the Europeans consider to be, basic human rights. One of them, of course, is the total independence of women. So that is what makes it impossible to think of it as a European religion. All right, it played a part in the history of Europe in the 14th, 15th century. True, no one would never deny that. And that was crucial in that sense. But it hasn't been any more than Judaism has been, although Judaism in a sense is because Judaism is the root of both Christianity and Islam, it has obviously has had an indirect role. But, you know, I don't think that Judaism, if you wanted to set up a strictly Orthodox community in Europe, that you would be actually, in a way, some sense, fulfilling a European perspective of how life should be lived. So that was the point of that comment. That one of the problems with bringing on board Turkey, for instance, was that in the 19 when this the whole project for include expanding Europe to possibly to include Turkey in the 1990s started before the takeover, as it were, by these parties of the Muslim right. Before that happened, then, this was something that a lot of people were very much in favor of. And as I said in that book, you know, Sarkozy was against it because he saw it as being, he was the one who saw that this was a Christian state, Europe was Christian and shouldn't be allowed in. And that was taken by some people to believe, I wasn't endorsing Sarkozy's view in that manner for, at all. And if you read The World's at War, there's a long passage there saying why, which was written, of course, in the 2005, that why it was essential that Turkey should be part of the European Union. But that was the other Turkey. That was the Turkey of Atatürk, right? And the Turkey that had come out of the First World War and had been there during the Second World War. So that is the Turkish People's Republic. And that is something quite different from the kind of Turkey that is emerging today. So I think that I would say, no, it is not a European religion because it doesn't bear those fundamental traits, which is essentially the set of values that enshrined in a sense in the Charter of Human Rights, and also this crucial distinction that the laws that govern the state are the laws made by man for man, and no beliefs false, in my view all religious beliefs are false, but no beliefs that have any bearing on the subject that do not come from a universal human consensus are to be accepted.
Why for you was Brexit an event foreseen?
Sorry, I didn't catch me. The line goes off fuzzy. Can you repeat that?
Why for you was Brexit an event foreseen?
Oh, because if you go back, if you read in the book, I mean, if you go back to the very beginning of 1945, I mean, you can see there's already a hostility towards the idea of being part of Europe, but then, as I said, you can look at the history of it, that in a way, Churchill's famous speech where he talks about a European United States of Europe, which is going to exclude Britain, that Britain, I mean, Churchill had this vision of Britain being part of a world in which there would be the United States, there would be the Britain and the British Empire, because he had no vision of the British Empire collapsing, which would be work hand in hand, and they would work hand in hand with the European Union, and then there would be the Soviet Union, would be the other on the other side of the Iron Curtain, and that's how the world would be organized, and Britain would play a crucial role because Britain would be a mediator between this new European power, which would be the EU, and on the one hand, and the United States on the other. But that never came about because Britain's power diminished at its astonishing speed after the end of the Second World War. And the whole geopolitics changed completely during the Cold War. But that was his object. And I think a lot of people within Britain, the British sort of directive held to that idea that they were all in favor of a European Union as long as it didn't involve them. Then later on, you get a more, as it were, amenable view to being part of a customs union. But the brief period under Edward Heath, when Britain actually went into and accepted them and became fully fledged part of what would eventually become the European Community, was very short lived. And in Britain has never. There's all sorts of levels in which it has never, ever shown really great interest in what's going on what Europe does in what's happening. I mean, I know that interest in what's happening in Europe in all European countries is low compared to what's happening locally, just as national elections arouse much less interest than local elections and so on. But nevertheless, there is a commitment to Europe, a visual commitment to Europe that goes all the way to teaching people in the schools what this is, which doesn't happen in Britain at all, or didn't happen. So I think that when this event happened, which was almost, you know, frivolous in the way it was conducted, it was clear that this is something which a lot of people, if they had still been alive, who were negotiating in 1945, 46, 47, would have said, "I told you so." You know, this is, if you do this, you're going against the country's history, you're going against its sense of itself, you're going against its needs and everything. We don't want to be part of Europe. We don't want to be part of the Union, et cetera, et cetera. And therefore, in that sense, it was a death foretold. Yes, I mean, certainly, I think it was. I mean, that was going to be the consequence. That doesn't mean that I thought it would happen. I, like many people, I at the time didn't believe that this was going to be sufficiently coherent, that there were enough, put it this way, there were enough people who knew what the consequences were likely to be, who would vote yes, stay. And the people who were voting against were so incoherent and so ignorant of what, for the most part, obviously not all of them, but for the most part were so ignorant of what they were voting for that they probably wouldn't bother to vote. So you'd have an extraordinarily low turnout and a very narrow Remain margin. And then Cameron would have got essentially what he wanted, and that would have been the end of the story. As it was, it tipped very slightly in the other direction. But I think it was foretold, as I say, because all sorts of levels, the commitment of Britain to the whole European project has been lukewarm, at least, to say the least.
Are you a Euro-optimist or pessimist?
No, pretty much an optimist. I mean, you know, states come and go, wars come and go. No, I mean, nothing's perfect. Everything works out. You have to be prepared with what you're getting. But I think it's survived for a very long period of time. It's brought immeasurably wealth to people who would not have otherwise had it. It's still doing that. I think if when Ukraine first wanted to join in 2014, that outpouring of enthusiasm, which of course is partly responsible for what's happening now, very largely responsible for happening, that outpouring of enthusiasm gives some sense of how people from the outside who, you know, saw themselves as being part of this project looked upon it. And, you know, nothing is perfect. Obviously, it doesn't work. All kinds of things need to be done. As I say in the end of the book, all kinds of changes need to be made if we're going to go under. It needs to be made a lot stronger than it is. And it's not quite sure how you're going to make it stronger in such a way without changing its basic equilibrium, without preserving the independence part, and without, you know, bringing back some kind of backlash a la Brexit. But that's not at all clear what the future is going to be, particularly, as you rightly point out in the beginning, in the light of the conflict in the Ukraine. But I think so far it has done extremely well, and it's also in ways that, you know, people don't really notice. One thing that's been mentioned many times before, but the general public doesn't really question it. The EU operates an extraordinary, powerful, systematic and effective system of regulations across the world. Because if you know, you can't get away with behaving badly in the EU if you're a major company, because a lot of your business is going to be done there. And therefore, if you can't get away from that, then those regulations reluctantly are then taken up by other states. So quite without any noise, without any, you know, without any force being exercised, these things that say, no, you can't, you think about the suits that have been brought against Google and Amazon and so on, you can't behave in this way. Seems as a source of regulations which simply don't exist in the rest of the world. And because they're universal regulations, those are they're transnational regulations, not just within one single state, their effect is enormous. So I think there are all sorts of hidden ways in which this project, I think, is not only destined to go on growing, because I suspect that the outcome of the, I may be talking through the top of my head here, but let me do so briefly, since I gather we're coming to the end. The end of the war in Ukraine will probably be the surrender of the Donbass region to Russia, because it's predominantly Russian anyway, and the Russian have been you know, using this system of voluntary or semi-voluntary migration, which the Turks used, the Ottomans used as well, and the Chinese used to secure frontier regions. They've been doing that since Peter the Great. So it's predominantly a Russian region. That will become part of Russia. What happens about Odessa? I don't know. That's a tricky question. But and then the rest of the Union, Ukraine, will then become, as it almost certainly is waiting to happen, will become part of the EU, and which will extend its strength, and it obviously create enormous problems, as bringing Romania and other places in the EU did create enormous problems of trying to, you know, accommodation to local customs, accommodation to local economic interests, et cetera, et cetera. It's not an easy task going from being a sort of pre-Soviet, former Soviet state into being a member of a modern European Democratic Union. But still, it can be done. It does happen. If you look at what, going back further to the 1990s, you did look at the impact of the EU had on the democratization in Spain and Portugal in the 1990s. It was massive. So I think that those are examples of what happens. And in Eastern Europe has been less good an example than that, and what's happened recently in Hungary and Poland. It may, the outcome of this may bring Poland and Hungary more into line. The Union needs strengthening in all sorts of ways, and as I say, the problem about it is how to do it without turning it into a super state. But I think there's a model there for the future, and I think there's a model there for the rest of the world too. I mean, it's the first, I think, of I won't be alive to see it, obviously, but it's probably nor will anybody listening, but it's the first of a step towards, as it were, something that looks very much like what Kant had in mind at a general level, a unification, a unified world of unified states brought together into perhaps federations of federations, a world federation of federations, put it that way. And if that happens, or anything like that happens, then the EU would have been the first step.
If you wanted people to take one thing away from your book, what would it be?
Probably that, actually. But this isn't. What I really say in the beginning. This is a project. This is an ambition that has been going on for a long time. This is a dream, if you like, but it's a dream with a possible reality. And I think that if you look at it, if you look at the intellectual history, which is what this book is, a history of how people have thought about it, how the aspirations they've had, the desires they've had, the ambitions they've put into it, the things they've tried to achieve through it. If you look at that, you will see that humankind is capable of organizing itself eventually into unions of, as the image on the cover jacket is attempting to point to, of a union of peace and justice. One of those figures is peace and the other is justice. And that is what matters. And that the only way to achieve that is through some kind of larger, complex, detailed union around a set of common values, a common set of common interests, obviously, a common values, a common legal system, and a political order which is shared by all.
On that observation, I would like to thank you very much, Professor, for being so kind as to speak with us today. This is Charles Cotillo. You've been listening to New Books in History, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. Thank you, Professor.
Thank you very much for having me.